What is it that holds you spellbound? This coming weekend, there will be fireworks. Is that something that holds you spellbound? If you've been out at Lake Louise or at Banff, it's a pretty impressive sight. Does that hold you spellbound? The Northern Lights, amazing to see. Maybe it's a newborn baby, or the Grand Canyon, or Niagara Falls. I love to stand right at that corner there where the falls go over. It's just so impressive. Maybe it's the running of a cheetah. Pretty impressive thing to see. Another thing, all of these are natural things that I've talked about, but a jet taking off, that's a pretty impressive sight, isn't it? And I'd love to go, when we were kids, my dad and my brother and I, we'd go out and stand on the roof of the old Terminal 1, and we just watch the jets take off. Another thing that's pretty impressive is in the restaurant on the top of the CN Tower. I went there once with a fellow who had never been out of the state of Ohio until he flew from Dayton to Toronto. When we took him up for lunch, he couldn't eat. As we were rotating, he just was spellbound. It was such an impressive sight. All of these things are pretty spectacular, aren't they? But what is spectacular according to Isaiah? And he promises. Look at 17b. Last week we looked at the first part of this chapter. He says, your eyes will behold the king in his beauty. What king is he talking about here? Is he talking about Hezekiah? Well, in some respects he could, because Hezekiah is a Christ type. But was Hezekiah really a sight of beauty? Was he talking about Christ in his messianic kingdom and establishing an earthly reign? Well, when Christ appeared in the incarnation, we read in Isaiah 53 at verse 2 that there was no beauty in him, that anyone should desire him. Now, I'm not suggesting that Jesus was ugly by any stretch of the imagination, but he was poor. He had the rough hands of a carpenter. He was sleep deprived much of the time. He was sun-dried skin because he was out a lot walking up and down from Galilee to Judah. He was dust covered. In fact, David, we had the one this morning where he went into the room and they didn't anoint him with oil, right? Because he was dust covered. And he was clad in rough garments. They were whole, but they were rough garments. I don't think anybody would have said that he was particularly beautiful. He certainly wouldn't have been among the glitterati of our day. Now, it's true that he showed tremendous kindness. Children loved him. They trusted him. But in his beauty, in his bodily form, while he was in the incarnation, you really can't say that he was glorious, because he even had to be transfigured to be glorious. He wasn't strikingly beautiful or majestic. Certainly not like those Renaissance and in many modern paintings where they have this picture of him in a beatific vision looking up into heaven. So what is it that Isaiah is telling us here? The king in his beauty. I think he's reflecting on something else than the messianic king. Going back to verse 2, he talks about the Lord who saves, who fills Zion with justice and righteousness, verse 5. Talks about Zion's treasure, its wisdom, its knowledge, in verse 6. He talks about the exalted one in verse 10. And then jump down to verse 22. The Lord our King. It's very clear that he's talking about looking beyond to Jehovah as his king. Now, this is Jesus, but it's the eschatological Jesus rather than the messianic Jesus. He's looking beyond into the everlasting kingdom of Jesus Christ. Jesus in his exalted glory, which was prefigured at the transfiguration, and it's the one that Paul writes about in Philippians 2. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name, the one we read of in Revelation 19. So that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Now, what is it that makes Jesus in this sense beautiful? One is his moral perfection, without a doubt, his holiness. Who can accuse me of sin, he says. Moral perfection. Overflowing love. He says, while he's on the cross, to Mary, to John, behold your mother, your son. He's pouring out love on the cross to these two individuals, and he's pouring out love as he's dying for us. Abounding in love, overflowing. In justice, he's beautiful. Justice is accomplished in Jesus. Justice is poured out on him, but he vindicates his people. And he has a victory parade. He's beautiful in his wisdom. It provides an endless and exciting challenge for us, the wisdom of Jesus Christ. He's beautiful in his creative works. He created this universe. Through him, all things were created. And all was very good. It was beautiful. And in his resurrected being, he is glorious and beautiful. And so are we going to be beautiful, because we will be like him. New creations. This is what Isaiah is spellbound by. Behold the king in his beauty. Before we leave this, though, notice that he opens verse 17 with the word your. Now, in this instance, it's interesting because it's the second person singular rather than the plural. So who is he talking about? Your eyes, singular. Well, he's probably talking to Hezekiah. Your eyes, Hezekiah, you're the king. You are going to behold the king in his beauty. But we can take it one step further. When Isaiah is addressing you in the singular, sorry, in the second person, but singular. He is addressing you as individuals, not collectively. And so we can see it that each person is being addressed individually. And so there's a question right there. Do you individually behold Jesus the King in his beauty? So do you even want to see Jesus in his beauty? And as I was preparing, I was thinking of that song by Bart Millard. I'm sure you've heard it. The Mercy Me Band plays it. And it's, I can only imagine what it will be like when I walk by your side. I can only imagine what my eyes will see when your face is before me. Is that your desire, to see Jesus in his beauty? So that's the opening that we have here. We have Hezekiah as a trembling creature at this point. The armies are surrounding the Jerusalem. They've destroyed the armies of Sennacherib. They've destroyed 46 cities already in Judah. And they are surrounding Jerusalem. And as we will see in a chapter or two, the Rabbi Shenka is going to just belittle God, and he's going to say, who do you think you are, Hezekiah? I can just come in and wipe you out. And so what does Hezekiah need to do here? He needs to listen to Isaiah, who's been encouraging him to trust God. And look what Isaiah tells him and tells the people in verses 18 and 19. He says, your heart will muse on the terror Where is the one who counted? Where is he who weighed the tribute? Where is he who counted the towers? You will see no more the insolent people, that is the Assyrians, the people of an obscure language, obscure speech, that is, they spoke Aramaic, that you cannot comprehend, stammering in a tongue that you cannot understand. What Isaiah is telling Hezekiah, you behold the king in his beauty, and you are going to see a change. It's going to happen. Significant major change is coming. In some places, people say, if you don't like the weather, wait a minute, and it will change. And this is the idea that change can come rapidly. And so it is with God's dealings with mankind. How is it that he's going to show that he is in control? Well, notice that he says here, your heart will muse. So we're going to muse on something. The king of verse 17 is going to end the war against Israel in an instant. We'll see that in chapter 37 at verse 36 when we get there. 185,000 Assyrians are going to be killed instantly. God's going to change the whole complexion of the Middle East in an instant. And the result is that the people are going to muse. They're going to contemplate. They're going to meditate on the terror of the war that they had endured and how suddenly it was overturned. A greater terror God had visited on their enemies. Contemplate this. Think about it. The enemies of Christ, the enemies of Christians, what do you want to take for an example? Those who expel a Christian because he makes some sort of question about evolution, and he gets kicked out of a high school as a high school teacher or as a university teacher. Or if you just dare to question the idea of same-sex marriage, for instance, if you're a photographer or a cake baker or people that rent out a facility, and you aren't willing to concede this, to give in and support same-sex marriage, you'll be driven out of business. We had an example this week. Doug Ford fired Tanya Granick Allen, who is the PC candidate in Mississauga. You remember she ran against Ford and against, what was the other two? Mulrooney's daughter and... So she ran there for the leadership. And what he said is, we are an inclusive party. Okay, we're inclusive, but we won't include Christians. So we're not really an inclusive party. And she was called homophobic, which is nonsense, because that means you're afraid of homosexuals? No, she's not homophobic. But it's just a buzzword that people throw out these days. We think of the hardship now. We muse on it now, is what Isaiah is saying. You'll muse on the hardship now, but you are going to contemplate and muse on a much greater terror that awaits our enemies when he overthrows them. And it's just going to be awesome, is what he's saying to Hezekiah. The second thing, they muse, but notice what's going to be missing is the second thing. Isaiah's rhetorical question here is where? Where is he who weighed the tribute? Where is he who counted the towers? Something is missing, is what he's saying. And these are the people that were going around and inventorying the infrastructure of the city, and they're nowhere to be found. The enemies of the church are like Haman. You remember that he was licking his lips, thinking how great he was going to be, that Esther had invited him to a banquet, that he had been promoted, and he was just so thrilled, and he was going to put Mordecai on the gallows. And what happened? That very night, in the space of a few hours, the king couldn't sleep, and Haman's whole life was turned upside down, and he was dead within a few hours. He was missing from the scene altogether, nowhere to be found. And this missing message here of the missing, where, Isaiah repeats it, reminds us that we never should lose hope in our God. God will overturn the gloating enemy when we least expect it, and certainly when they least expect it. Third thing we notice here is there's mutes here. Notice what he says about this language, the people of an obscure speech that you cannot comprehend, stammering in a tongue that you cannot understand, that you won't hear it anymore. It'll be gone. They will be muted. The Assyrian army spoke Aramaic, whereas the people of Judah spoke Hebrew, and they're going to be gone. The armies are just going to be completely gone from all of Judah in a very short time after this prophecy right here. We're talking a matter of weeks after this prophecy. No, even days after this prophecy. That these people are going to be muted. If they don't speak the language of Zion, they will be excluded. They will be muted. They will have no inheritance in the kingdom of God. And the language of Zion, of course, for us isn't speaking Hebrew. It's being in the kingdom, being with the Lord Jesus. And how are we to apply the meaning of this section then? Well, we can say that in these verses, 18 and 19, Isaiah is telling us three things that God is not. That God is not. First of all, God is not ignorant. He knows the events that are happening in the world. He's intimately involved with them. He's in control of them. Second thing he's not is he's not insensitive. He knows what our needs are. He knows what we have a need as a community. Think about this. He loved us so much that he sent his son. Don't ever forget that. He is not insensitive to our needs. Christ died for you. Third thing Isaiah is telling us in these verses is God is not impotent. He will act. And go back and look at verse 10. Notice what it says three times. We looked at that last week. Now. In his time, he's going to act. In his time, he's going to reveal his glory. In his time, he's going to achieve the victory. Again, I reflect on Revelation 19. At the end there, the beast and the false prophet are thrown into the pit. Jesus is the one riding out in victory on his white horse. Is this the one you trust? He's not ignorant of what's going on. He's not insensitive to your needs. He's not impotent to act. He will act on your behalf. Now, what is it that Isaiah points Hezekiah to? You will see the king in his beauty, and they will see a land that stretches afar. Going back to verse 17. They're going to see this prodigious scene of serenity, a land stretched out. Jerusalem and Judah is going to be restored to peace. And they had peace for about 100 years after this. But they kept turning away from God, and eventually he had to take them into captivity in Babylon. But this isn't what Isaiah is talking about ultimately. Because this is only a temple for 100 years here. And after the return from the Babylonian captivity, Judah had shrunk down to such a small territory that it was basically insignificant in the world scenes. Isaiah is looking forward to the spiritual kingdom, the New Testament church age, and ultimately even further into the eschatological kingdom. The end where Jesus has established the new heavens and the new earth. Jesus says, in my Father's house are many rooms. And in Revelation 21, it's an amazing passage when you read the description of the New Jerusalem. He describes a massive city. I don't know if you've taken the dimensions of this city, the size of it, but if you turn the stadia into miles, this is a cube that would sit on the earth from Toronto to Winnipeg and just as high. We're talking a massive city in terms of its typical dimensions or its hyperbolic dimensions that are described to us. Part of this is that God is saving a vast multitude that no one can number, Revelation 7, 9. He's filling heaven with people every single day. This is when he says, you will see a land that stretches afar, way beyond little tiny Judah. After this, after the Assyrian defeat, or even after the Babylonian return from the Babylonian captivity. So how does he describe this place? A land that stretches afar. Look at verses 20 and 21. Behold, Zion, the city of our appointed feasts. Your eyes will see Jerusalem. Now, again, I'm looking beyond the temporal Jerusalem here. An untroubled habitation, an immovable tent whose stakes will never be plucked up, nor will any of its cords be broken. This can't apply to the temporal Jerusalem because it was destroyed in 586 by the Babylonians and again in 70 AD by the Romans. It can't be that. But there the Lord in majesty will be for us a place of broad rivers and streams where no galley with oars can go, nor majestic ship can pass. So the first thing in these verses, we've seen it's a prodigious land. The second thing is it's a land of pilgrimage. Zion is the pilgrim's destination. You remember Jesus as a boy. He went with his parents to Jerusalem for the feasts. We read that in Luke. It was a pilgrimage. These Hallel Psalms, 113 through 118, are the psalms that they would sing on their pilgrimages they were heading to Jerusalem. For the church now, our destination is Jerusalem. John says, I looked and a new Jerusalem was coming down. That's our destination. We are pilgrims just like the pilgrims at the time of Jesus going up to the city of Jerusalem. We are looking for a city whose builder is God, the city that Abraham looked for, as we read in Hebrews 11 and 10. We are looking for that city in which we will attend the marriage supper of the Lamb, Revelation 19, 9. So it's a prodigious place. It's a land of pilgrimage. It's a peaceful place, untroubled habitation he talks about here. See, in verse 20, an untroubled habitation. It's peaceful. And ultimately in the New Jerusalem, there's no more pain, no more death, no more tears. Revelation 21, 4. It's a permanent place. In Hebrews 12, 28, it says, we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. It's a permanent place. It's also a protected place. Look at verse 21. Now, verse 21 is difficult to interpret. Some are saying that Isaiah says here that Jerusalem will be surrounded by large bodies of water. Do you see that? But you know that Jerusalem only has a little stream going by it. So I don't think Isaiah is giving us a geography or a topography lesson here. He's not suggesting that. Rather, this is a spiritual application. It's the same sort of thing that we see in Ezekiel 47, where from the temple, a little trickle of water comes out, and as Ezekiel walks along, it gets wider and wider and wider and turns into a giant river that no one could cross. And there, of course, Ezekiel's talking about the gospel message going out. And I think that we have to understand here that this is a protected place in that it's going to be surrounded by large bodies of water. But notice that you won't have the boats coming in, the enemy's boats. Assyria's armies never came by boat. They were land armies. They came down from the north where Syria is today, and they came down by land. And so this isn't talking about Assyria's armies in boats. This has got a different application, that it's a symbol that's indicating to us the protected nature that even enemy ships couldn't approach, even though it's surrounded by great bodies of water. It's a prophecy of the New Testament age, the gospel going out to the nations. Lots of water, but enemy ships cannot come near. But there's more even in this prodigious place. We've seen that it's a land of pilgrimage. It's a peaceful land. It's a permanent land. It's protected land. Look at verse 23. Your cords hang loose. They cannot hold the mast firm in its place or keep the sail spread out. They pray and spoil in abundance. Then pray and spoil in abundance will be divided. Even the lame will take the prey. So I'm going to ask you, please come up and interpret this verse. It's a difficult one, too, to interpret. But here's how I understand it. In this instance, the word your is in the second person plural, not singular. So who is Isaiah addressing? He's not addressing Hezekiah like he did in verse 17. He's addressing Assyria, is what he's addressing. It's a changed focus here. Now, there's a debate among the commentators. Is this imagery about ships? And the ESV has translated as a mast and sail. So they've implied that it's a ship that they're talking about. It's not an incorrect translation. But you could also translate it as military flags on a mast or post. Both are legitimate translations. Regardless of which translation you have, the point is that their cords are slack. They are not flying the sail or the mast. The Assyrian army's banner is gone limp, is the point that's being made here. Whether it's a hoisted sail or a hoisted flag, it has gone limp. And what's happening? They've fled. They've left everything behind. And the plunder has been left. After the Assyrian army was destroyed that night, the people came out of Jerusalem and they collected the booty that was left behind, the plunder, and they kept carrying it away. There was so much of it left. And that's what's being referred to in this. And it's interesting that what we have is that it is a foreshadow of what Jesus talks about in the Beatitudes, that the meek are blessed, for they will inherit the earth. It's a similar kind of concept to what God told the Israelites to do when they were leaving from Egypt. And he told them to take from the ladies to take jewelry and stuff with them. They plundered the Egyptians on the way out. And I've used an illustration here. Think about this. This church building was built by Muslims. Ali, who's the chairman of the site supervisor, is a Muslim. Mark Hamidi is a Muslim. Fred is a Muslim. In a sense, we've plundered the Egyptians. It's kind of cool when you think about it. So God is blessing the church, taking from the world. That's what's happening here with Assyria. God makes the world support the church. The meek will inherit the earth. God makes the world support the church. And then there is a priority in here. I've titled this series all along, The Gospel of Isaiah. And I've tried to point out to you that almost invariably, even in the middle of the woe sections, there is almost invariably a positive message of hope. Now, we're getting into sections now where there's much, by the time we get up beyond chapter 40, the gospel is very clear in Isaiah, but it's there earlier, in the earlier parts as well. We are talking about the church age, the messianic kingdom, the Isaiah 9, "For unto us